This is Fran with the Saturday, July 18th reading of the Sun. And we start off with the top of the front page. Not good news, as is sometimes the case, but Dateline Boston and written by Aaron Curtis. His email given as acurtis@lolsun.com, A-C-U-R-T-I-S at lolsun.com. There's a bank manager who turned a Tewksbury Citizens Bank branch into his own cash pipeline, draining hundreds of thousands of dollars, mostly by pulling money straight from two ATMs, is now headed to prison. Jeffrey Castro, C-A-S-T-R-O, 34 years of age, of Lawrence, was sentenced in federal court this past Wednesday to a year and one day in prison, 5 years of supervised release, and $375,233 restitution, covering the amount that prosecutors say he stole over roughly 15 months. Court documents reveal that Castro took the money to help feed a long-standing gambling addiction. Assistant Attorney Timothy Moran described a methodical week-after-week scheme that unfolded from May 2024 to August 2025, usually on Mondays and Tuesdays, the days that Castro typically suffered sports betting losses. And according to Moran's sentencing memorandum, Mr. Castro would remove cash from the branch's two ATMs and hide it within his suit jacket, then shift money from deposit bins and incoming cash shipments to cover the missing funds. When the numbers still did not line up, he manipulated balance sheets and altered deposit figures to maintain what they say, quote here, the illusion of accuracy, end quote. Moran said that Castro's position as branch manager made the thefts harder to detect because he had access to the financial reports and safeguards which were in place to prevent and detect theft. Bank investigators first spotted a $21,000 discrepancy back in April 2024, but took no immediate action. More than a year later, on August 15th, an on-site audit uncovered a dramatic shortfall of $354,233, and Castro did not show up for work that day. But when he was interviewed the next morning, he immediately admitted the thefts, accepting sole responsibility, and explained that the embezzlement supported his sports betting habit. Citizens Bank later verified the total loss of $375,233. Moran wrote in a memorandum, quote, he had a chance to change his ways and seek therapy after the bank asked him about it the first time, but he did not do. In essence, he was the fox in charge of the hen house, end quote. In April, Castro pleaded guilty to one count of embezzlement by a bank employee. In the sentencing memorandum, Moran asked for a 15-month prison sentence, citing his gambling addiction and early acceptance of responsibility. But they argued that a term of incarceration was still necessary to reflect the seriousness of the offense and deter other bank employees from exploiting their access to cash and internal controls. In a victim impact statement submitted to the court, Bert Oliveira, Senior Vice President and Head of Corporate Security for Citizens Bank, wrote that, quote, banks occupy a unique position of trust in society, and warned that misconduct by a manager extends far beyond the direct financial loss associated with the criminal conduct. Oliveira said that embezzlement by a bank insider undermines customer confidence in the bank and creates uncertainty among individuals who depend upon financial institutions to safeguard their assets. Such conduct also unfairly tarnishes the reputation of the overwhelming majority of Citizen Bank employees who perform their duties with integrity and dedication. Thousands of banking professionals work diligently every day to protect customers, comply with regulatory requirements, detect fraud, and uphold the highest ethical standards. When one employee abuses his position for personal gain, it can cast doubt upon the professionalism and commitment of countless innocent colleagues who have spent years earning the trust of customers and the communities they serve. In a sentencing memorandum, Mr. Castro's attorney, Douglas Ryan, sought a far lighter punishment. He asked the court to impose 1 day of incarceration for his client, followed by 4 years of supervised release, arguing that continued treatment, not prison, was the most effective way to address the root cause of the crime. Attorney Ryan said Castro's actions were driven by a lifelong gambling addiction that began in childhood and spiraled into weekly losses that fueled the thefts. He said that gambling had been an ever-present part of his life since he was a toddler, shaped by an upbringing where his mother also struggled with addiction and worked for a gambling outfit in the Dominican Republic. Ryan told the court that Castro has taken substantial steps to address the issue, including going for treatment at Forest Behavioral Health in Bedford, where he's being treated for multiple diagnoses related to gambling and mental health. He also attends an additional group session focused on gambling through Alcoholics Anonymous and has complied with all treatment conditions since his arrest. The defense attorney noted that Castro had worked at Citizens Bank for several years before his arrest and now holds a job at Amazon. Ryan said that Castro also helps care for his 2 young children days a week. Castro's wife and the stepmother of his 2 boys also submitted a letter to the court asking for mercy from the judge while describing him as an attentive father whose presence is central to the lives of his children. She wrote that he's been at every single game the boys have played and that they ran straight to their dad after winning a youth league championship. She further noted that Castro was working to better himself through treatment and weekly support sessions and quoted him as telling her, quote, "I never want my boys to go through what I went through in my childhood, and whatever they want, they will get, even if I have to get 2 jobs. She urged the court to consider the impact his absence would have on the children. She wrote, quote, "Mercy extended to him would also be mercy extended to 2 young boys who love their father deeply and need him in their lives," end quote. The central part of the page is actually taken up by a huge colored picture of the Talbot Mills Dam. And at least as of Saturday, the title is "No Go, Talbot Mills Dam Removal Rejected Again." And under the photo, it says, "The Talbot Mills Dam on the Concord River in Billerica, as seen in this photo, June 21st, 2025, Then it says, "After years of debate over whether it should be removed, a Middlesex Superior Court judge ruled on July 1st of this year that the Billerica Historic District's Commission must allow the dam's removal. However, the district voted 6-1 against the project Wednesday, and the board will meet judges if they vote against the project once again." This is the note under the photo. The article is by Peter Currier. His email, pcurrier@lowellsun.com. That's pcurrier@lowellsun.com. And Dateline, Billerica. After defying a court order and once again voting to reject a project to remove the Talbot Mills Dam from the Concord River, members of the Historic District's Commission could be faced with contempt of court charges if they make the same vote again in a special meeting coming up today, actually Monday. The BHDC met remotely last Wednesday with a single item on the agenda, a vote on whether to issue a certificate allowing the dam removal project to proceed. It was the 3rd time the commission had voted on this same proposal, the first one being June 2025 and the second one earlier in 2026, and both cases rejected it, preferring the dam to remain where it is. In response, Bob Martin, the owner of the dam, through his company called CRT Development Realty, and who's been an advocate for having it removed, filed a lawsuit in March to compel the commission to allow the dam removal to proceed. The decision in that lawsuit came July 1st from Middlesex Superior Court Judge John Pappas, who had annulled the BHDC's previous rejections of the removal project and ordered the commission, quote, to authorize and permit the Talbot Mills Dam Removal Ecological Restoration Project to proceed, end quote, within 14 days of his decision. That deadline was Wednesday night when the BHDC met remotely in a special meeting with the dam project as the only item on the agenda. The chairman, David Gagliardi, that's G-A-G-L-I-I-R-D-I, told The Sun that the commission would finally approve the project even if they weren't happy about it. But he ultimately cast the only vote in favor, with the final tally being 6-1 to reject the project. With the commission's vote being in defiance of the court order, another special meeting of the BHDC has been scheduled for today at 6:30 p.m., that's Monday, with that being the only item on the agenda. In another phone call with The Sun on Thursday, Mr. Gagliardi said he was told by town council that if the commission rejects the proposal again Monday, those who vote against the dam removal could face contempt of court charges, and another rejection would not be enough to stop the project. In that instance, Gagliardi said that the individual commission members would have to retain their own legal counsel. He said the overall impact of their no vote is completely irrelevant. The certificate will still be issued. So before taking the vote, the commission members took the time to express their frustration with the judge's decision and with the fact that the town's legal counsel did not represent the commission in the weeks leading up to the decision. In a court filing dated June 17th, town attorney Brian Bertram said the town, quote, will not further defend or fund the defense of this lawsuit in the name of the Billerica Historic District Commission or any other official or instrumentality of the town, end quote. BHDC member Mary Jones is quoted as saying, I would like just to say how disappointed I am in our town by not backing a committee instituted and fostered by the town. I feel our hands were tied behind our back, end quote. And that sentiment was shared by most members of the commission, save for alternate member Marlise Henderson, who has been a vocal supporter of the removal project. Henderson said she thinks, quoting her, the right thing done by not allowing town council to represent the commission's case. She said there was enough information for town council to see if not, if it would be. And she added that withholding the town attorneys spared Billerica taxpayers. Well, the rest of the commission seemed to disagree. Membership of the commission given access to read by Gagliardi, but ultimately voted historic to do the best we can to preserve and protect the historic resource. The dam was one of them. We weren't allowed to have our day in court to fully explain to a judge why we did what we did. When the judge's decision came down, Martin expressed optimism. Even with approval still needed by the Conservation Commission and the Department of Public Works, Martin said, quoting him again, it's not a done deal, but it's looking very encouraging. Now remember, he's the owner of the dam. He said this in a call to The Sun on July 6th. He added, we feel this will be a wonderful opportunity ecologically and recreationally for the community, end quote. In a message to The Sun on Thursday, he expressed some frustration at the commission's vote, but said, we'll give this a week or so. I would anticipate that the town's attorney will share their legal perspective to follow the direction of the court's ruling and reverse this position. He said, this is a clear violation of a public group violating our court's directive. Unbelievable, end quote. The dam, as it exists now, has been in place since 1828. But there have been other dams in the same spot on the Concord River, going back to 1711, serving as power for the nearby mills and later as infrastructure to support the Middlesex Canal. The BHDC and other opponents of the dam's removal have cited the structure's historic significance for the town of Billerica and the region as a reason for it to stay. Those in favor of removing the dam, including local watershed organizations like OARS, claim that doing so will have ecological benefits like reducing water stagnation, cooling the water, opening up passage for migratory fish, and fighting against invasive plant species like water chestnut. and the last remaining article on the front page is from the State House News Service, this time written by Sam Drysdale, Dateline Boston. It says, less than a week after signing the new state budget, Governor Healey filed a supplemental budget Wednesday, seeking another $100 million for public schools this year. Her announcement comes amid a tough budget cycle for schools all around the state, which have had to make cuts to teachers, staff, and services. Many communities have been forced to make difficult decisions, raising their own taxes or cutting school funding. Healey said, quoting her, in this moment I want our teachers, our educators, our counselors, our schools to know they have our support. I want our students and towns to know that they have our support as well. We don't want to see these programs, these services, or these positions cut because of tough budgets. She said this during a press conference at the State House, flanked by education leaders, legislators, and local officials. And it comes as she is also campaigning for a second term, asking voters to deliver her back to the Connor office in November. The strain on municipal budgets has been among the largest challenges this session and a repeated campaign theme. Education Secretary Stephen Zrike, that's Z-R-I-K-E, is quoted as saying, we have seen and heard the challenge we face to ensure that mission-critical programs, services, and resources are sustained and expanded so students receive the highest quality education they really deserve. He noted the significant fiscal pressure. The supplemental budget will be funded with projected and unbudgeted revenue from the state's 4% surtax on households that bring in over $1 million in a year. The surtax is estimated to generate $2.7 billion in revenue this fiscal year, and collections have far exceeded projections in past years. The revenue source, which is only a few years old, has funded a huge swell of investments into education, including for universal free school meals, free community college, child care grants, and backfilling dollars needed to commit the state's obligations under the Student Opportunity Act for general K-12 funding. The governor is proposing that the state distribute this $100 million on an enrollment basis to schools. She said it amounts to an average increase of $112 per student among all 319 school districts. The Massachusetts Teachers Association, the largest teachers union in Massachusetts, in a release, said that the supplement significant but still not enough to fully counterbalance the challenges facing our communities. Quoting them, spiraling costs for health care and special education and the outdated limitations that Proposition 2.5 place on municipalities are forcing cities and towns to make decisions that are not in the best interest of students and families, unquote. Amesbury Mayor Cassandra Gove, G-O-V-E, who is also the president of the Massachusetts Municipal Association, echoed these sentiments, quoting her, as you and your team know, Governor, cities and towns in all corners of the Commonwealth are facing structural budget challenges that are impossible for us to solve on our own. These challenges are a direct result of a big storm, rising costs, and limited ability for cities and towns to generate revenues. In the fiscal 2027 budget that Governor signed earlier this month, she and the legislature revived the Foundation Budget Review Commission, which will look at the formula that distributes state dollars to schools. School officials, municipal leaders, teachers and students have been calling on the legislature and the governor to act for years, saying that the formula no longer works in a world of post-COVID inflation. Lawmakers resisted acting until this year. They say the time is right now that the six-year Student Opportunity Act is fully implemented. Governor Healey said she looks forward to the funding commission's work, but, quote, we can't wait, end quote. And she proposes the supplement now, ahead of the start of next school year. She called on the legislature to act on it within the month. Quoting her again, we know that cities and towns are having to make some real-time decisions now for the fall, and I don't want to see us go backwards. Having worked very hard to get ourselves atop the national rankings for the first time in years in education, I don't want us to go backwards. And going on to the local page, on page 3 are local news. At the top of the page, we have a picture of former Dracut Assistant Town Manager and Finance Director Catherine Foster. She has just recently resigned. This is by correspondent Prudence Brighton, B-R-I-G-H-T-O-N, and Dateline Dracut. The town is operating right now with vacancies in 2 key positions at the top of its organizational chart. Town Manager Kate Hodges confirmed that Assistant Town Manager and also Finance Director Catherine Foster recently resigned, as has also Town Engineer Russell Tedford. Foster's resignation was a surprise because she had recently returned from being absent on maternity leave. Foster began maternity leave in early February and returned in early June. She attended the June 3rd town meeting, but as a non-resident, she could not vote. Foster started her job in Dracut a year ago, coming to the position from Tingsboro, where she worked for 2 years. She had held the titles of Assistant Town Manager and Finance Director there as well. Tingsboro Town Manager Colin Loisel valued her work there, as he told the Sun. Hodges said that when Foster returned to work in June, she came back on a part-time basis. The schedule at Town Hall has been demanding because of budget-related layoffs across departments and high tension levels now between the Board of Selectmen and the school committee over the proposed new Campbell School. Word of the assistant town manager's departure began to spread across town Monday thanks to a Facebook post that purports to be from Foster herself. Dracut has had a difficult time filling staff vacancies. In addition to trouble hiring personnel, the pay scale for positions in Dracut are lower than in neighboring communities, so town personnel are leaving for higher paying jobs elsewhere. Hodges said the town engineer resigned to take a much higher paying job. His new job is in the private sector. His departure was not sudden, so they were able to have a party for him. Foster's departure was abrupt. The Sun reached out to Miss Foster through social media. In her reply, she said, quote, "Haha, word travels quickly." She added she does not have another job lined up. She did not return a follow-up message asking if she would say more about her departure. And we have a photo in the middle of the page of Thao Lan, that's T-H-A-O-L-A-N, Mr. Sixto de Jesus, and Senator Vanna Howard, as seen at a dinner called the Commonwealth Heroines Ceremony at the State House June 24th. I should say a ceremony rather than a dinner. Miss Lan is also in a smaller picture, black and white, featured, showing her State Senate citation and certificate of recognition received on June 24th at the State House. This is a so-called submitted article, Dateline Boston. Lowell entrepreneur Thao Lan was recently celebrated at the Massachusetts State House as a 2026 Commonwealth heroine. She was nominated by Senator Vanna Howard, Democrat of Lowell, and she was honored for her unwavering behind-the-scenes dedication to selflessly uplifting the Lowell community as a business owner, creative, and nonprofit volunteer. The Massachusetts Commission on the Status of Women hosted the annual Commonwealth Heroine Ceremony June 24th, recognizing a historic class of 147 outstanding women from across the state. She was chosen for her measurable impact across Lowell, utilizing her skills and platform in advocacy, event organizing, and volunteering to help others reach their full potential without seeking public praise. Howard said about her, "She pours her soul into everything she does. She believes in people and helps them achieve their full potential while using her skills and her platform to uplift her community. It's an honor to recognize her as a 2026 Commonwealth heroine." Miss Lan's recognition highlights the grassroots leaders who are the glue that keep communities together. She's a dedicated mom, seasoned deep tissue sports therapist, infant massage teacher, mentor, and published author committed to fostering well-being. As the owner and the founder of Push Muscular Restoration in North Chelmsford, she's honed her leadership and strategic planning skills while building a reputation for excellence and innovation. And she helps clients and practitioners take control of their health through evidence-based pain management and self-care. Her expertise lies in supporting endurance athletes with targeted treatments to enhance performance and expedite recovery, as well as providing alternative solutions for individuals who are seeking to avoid surgery through specialized techniques that alleviate pain and promote holistic healing. As a dedicated advocate for community well-being and a passionate supporter of local nonprofits, she has prioritized supporting initiatives that create lasting positive impact. She served for many years as a board member for organizations like Coalition for a Better Acre, the Wish Project, and the Cambodian Mutual Assistance Association, bringing a wealth of experience in leadership, strategic planning, and community engagement, as well as event planning member with the Lowell Women's Week, Annual Breakfast Committee, and the Women Accelerator She Rise Gala, to name just a couple. She also volunteers her time with local leaders and organizations to develop fundraising strategies, build community partnerships, and advocate for resources that will help families thrive. She is passionate about connecting people to essential resources and uplifting those who make a difference every day. One of her creative ways to do this has been her series of interviews on her own podcast called Your Favorite Nosy Neighbor, which is on Facebook and YouTube, to highlight important leaders and nonprofits. Four other honorees from the 1st Middlesex Senate District, nominated by Representative Tara Hong, were Susie Chun, that's C-H-H-O-U-N, of Lowell, Valerie Opara, nominated by Representative Rodney Elliott, Teresa Clawson, C-L-A-W-S-O-N, of Tingsboro, nominated by Representative Colin Gary, and Bryn Durno, D-U-R-N-O, of Pepperell, nominated by Representative Scarsdale. To learn more about the 2026 class of honorees, visit masscsw.org. This is a long one now. masscsw.org /2026/6/17. And again, I'll repeat that. To learn more about the class of honorees for 2026, you can visit masscsw.org/2026/06/17. And we also have the 5-minute read, what's happening or has happened in Lowell or around Lowell. And these two first ones are actually about Lowell. It says Heritage Properties, and there's a photo going along with that of a Mr. Scott March. It says Heritage Properties, a locally owned and operated real estate investment development and management company, announced its next phase of growth, a new in-house general contracting division. It will be led by Heritage Properties' new Vice President of Business Development, Scott March. As I say, he's pictured in this small photo here. He will join Patrick Monahan, Nate Latiolais, L-A-T-I-O-L-A-I-S, and Luke Brown. Heritage Properties Construction Division will focus its initial efforts on 50 to 250 unit multifamily developments throughout Lowell, in southern New Hampshire, and the coastal region. It will assemble estimating, project management, and operations internally to provide clients with faster operations and direct communication and collaboration. The president of the group, Jeff Bush, said, "We're thrilled to enter this next chapter of growth at Heritage Properties while welcoming a new team members. Over the course of our company's 45 plus year history, we've built the relationships, the market knowledge, and now the team to step in as a true partner during the construction process." Heritage Properties Construction Division is currently working to complete reconstruction of the company's 37-unit multifamily project, which is called the Emery. That's located at 218 Middlesex Street, Lowell. It's scheduled to open for occupancy in September. And following the completion of that, it's slated to begin work on the Heard Street redevelopment project in downtown Lowell. Again, for more information, you can go online to ne-hp.com/construction. ne-hp.com/construction. Also from Lowell, Lowell Rotary Club grants scholarships to deserving high school seniors who are residents of Lowell. They can be used for colleges, community colleges, or trade schools, and they reach out to Lowell schools every spring to find students best representing the values of the Rotary through community service and a meaningful high school experience. The club awarded $1,000 scholarships to 16 new applicants. Those winners and their parents attended the June 16th meeting of the club at the Tijuana Grill on Market Street in downtown Lowell so as to accept their checks. Past President Jim Pope said, "We were impressed with this year's submissions. All the students were well-rounded and dedicated to our community." The local Rotary Club was founded back in 1920 and has been serving the Lowell area for more than 100 years. At the international level, the Rotary has 1.2 million members in virtually every country in the world and is known especially for its work to eradicate polio. For more information, you can email potrotary@gmail.com. That's potrotary@gmail.com. And again from Lowell, all three this time are from Lowell. It says, save the dates, the Lowell Folk Festival. The countdown is on for the 39th annual Lowell Folk Festival. For the city's signature event, it will take place in 6 days. The festival opens with the traditional parade of flags on Friday. That's July 24th. That's 6:15 p.m. And runs through Sunday, July 26th, at various venues in the downtown Lowell area. Nearly all of downtown Lowell will be closed to vehicular traffic so as to create a walkable festival universe, and it'll feature more than 60 musical acts and other performers on 4 different stages. Food vendors will be serving a variety of distinctive culinary experiences. There'll be numerous art and family exhibits and also dance tents. The Discovery Museum will also return with the Discovery Lowell Play Space, a vibrant, full-sensory hub for kids and families to explore, learn how to play together. This year's festival will take place as Lowell celebrates its bicentennial. And for the schedule and the map of festivities, here we have another one of these difficult email addresses, or I should say links, online links. For the schedule of the festival, visit bit.ly/3, capital letters RCH, the number 0, capital letter L, and capital letter Q. Again, bit.ly/3, capital letters RCH, the number 0, and capital letters LQ.